Hi, Bill.
Hi, Yasmin.
Welcome to another episode of the Workaround Podcast. My name is Yasmin Werner, and my guest today is Bill Boorman. Fantastic to meet you, Bill.
Yeah, and you.
Thank you. Your trademark is you never wear a suit and you always wear a hat, right?
Yes.
Bill, my first question to you is, what made you already laugh today? Is there something?
What made me already laugh today? I've laughed at a few things. So I had a meeting with a startup and quite an established business, jobs as a service. Mm-hmm. In here in Berlin.
Do you want to say the name or?
Yeah, it's jobs as a service. Yeah. Or job ads partnership. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But okay. I think they handle about 80% of the job postings in Germany. So very well, Andy Bird, very well established business. But we just have fun, and I just like being in Berlin. I like being in Berlin. It's the only place where you turn up, and it's kind of chocolate on the table at 10 a.m. with bars of chocolate and all this kind of stuff. And we just had a... So already I laughed a bit at that. I always laugh a little bit at Facebook, some of my friends. I checked in because it was at the office was at the Irish Embassy. So I checked in at the Irish Embassy and said I was going to get a new passport because of Brexit. So I've had comments all day on Facebook.
Oh my God.
About Brexit. So it's been kind of interesting. You have to make yourself smile in these depressing times.
Yeah, I see. But you're ranked as one of the most influential people in the field of online recruitment. How did that happen? Yeah, can you explain that?
It really happened just by building a network and being just being active, really. And I think the other thing is not trying to be a brand and not being deliberate about it, just being yourself online and talking about the things that interest you, and mixing it with a strong passion for recruiting and HR and topics which are orientated around people, a passion for digital and where that's going to take us, and then just being very open as a person in everything from politics to things that I love, like art and cooking and all this kind of stuff. And I think when you do that, people respond to that.
Mm-hmm. Could you give us a quick run through your life?
My life, what did you do? And so my very first job was at 16, in an agency. So I literally got off the train at Liverpool Street, started a job in an agency, had an agency, recruitment agency career for a lot of years, ending with being a director for training and HR and projects and all kinds of things for a recruitment business that we grew from six offices to about 175 over 12 and a half years.
So you started with HR?
Yeah,
from the
recruiting. Recruiting. Yeah. And then moved over to, had a training company for 7 years, six really successful years. Seventh year was recession. The recession came along. I went bankrupt with the business and personally and everything else, and found myself for the first time coming out of corporate life with nothing in the diary. And it was the start of social media, really. So it was kind of 11 years ago. And as a result, I spent all day tweeting, and I created, before podcasts, I created like one of the first, or the first one in Europe, I think, recruiting radio show where people would phone in. We'd have a published phone call. It's more popular in America. So kind of the very early days of podcast, early days of blogging, I launched a blog. I ran an event called True, which is an unconference, recruiting unconference. So just did lots of activity to see where that ended up. And that moved me into doing some work for Hard Rock Cafe. And we launched recruiting for the opening of a new store in Florence. We did all the hiring in 2 weeks. It was 125 people. It was done end-to-end in Facebook, including offers. And this is, you're talking 8-9 years ago. So, you know, when Facebook was still very much a personal channel. And that was really successful. So that made me a little bit digitally famous, I suppose, in our space. It was the case study at all the conferences and so on. We won a lot of awards. And as a result of that, I did work for Oracle, then the BBC, and it was the launching of social media. It was this combination of recruiting, social media, branding, and through that into technology. So I work with startups. I work with 7 startups on product. JobPal here in the chatbot here in Berlin. So started working with startups, with VCs, investors on what's going on in the market. I speak at, do a lot of research into what's happening in digital recruiting and HR. So, and I work with companies like Cisco and Oracle and so on their technology and methodology, how they're going to work. So it's been really interesting. It's lots of work that fits together. Plus I do the conferences and the research. So it's all kinds of work that fits together into something interesting.
Yeah. So it was more or less like a coincidence that a lot of
I think it's completely coincidence. So, yeah, I think what happens in the digital age is you can network. And I was in a fortunate position because I had nothing to sell in the beginning. I networked without an objective. So I wasn't looking for customers, right?
Mm-hmm.
So typically people network with a sales objective of who can you connect with. I wasn't. I was just interested in interesting conversations. And I was also interested in really interested in geography and what was going on elsewhere, because really Twitter gave us that first opportunity to connect directly with people in Australia and Singapore and China and anywhere where people were online. Yes. You could connect who were having interesting conversations about recruiting. So I connected with people without purpose in recruiting and HR and built a network. And I think the lessons that I learned from that is when you build a network, if you have to make a decision about, am I going to try and make money from my network or because of my network? And if you're trying to make money from your network, you're really building a network of prospects or targets, whatever you're doing. If it's recruiting, it might be candidates, it might be clients, whatever it is. Whereas if you're going to make money from your network, it's because the knowledge you're going to gain, the contribution you're going to get, the connections you're going to make. So my networking has always been about that, and that the places where we make money, which is why the projects that I do are very different. Everything from building communities of developers in India for someone like Cisco to graduate recruiting at KPMG and so on. And a company called NASPERS I work with every year, who are...
From Google?
Yeah, NASPERS are the... Well, NASPERS are the biggest internet company in the world that nobody's ever heard of. They're like the sixth biggest internet company. They own all kinds of things, just not in the US. So I think what happens is the work that you do in those places becomes obvious. You know, you don't market, you don't sell. Where people want to work together, it's obvious. Where you're just being helpful and talking to people, giving them your advice, that's also obvious. And the mission's really simple, which is how do we make recruiting and HR better and make the most of this opportunity we're getting through digital transformation, which is changing our businesses. Whereas what I'm seeing in a lot of cases is digital transformation actually means how do we do the things we used to do in the same way, just online, right? So I'm very passionate about, no, this is an opportunity to make things better every time we change things, whether it's the advent of mobile, now it's data, algorithms, big data stuff, work is changing. How do we match up what we do as organizations with what people want?
Can you explain a bit more what your day job nowadays looks like?
Yeah, so I have no idea. So it really depends what and where I wake up. Yeah. So probably...
So in an interview I read...
Go on.
I read in an interview that your job is basically being the boomer.
That's it. Yeah. I mean, that really is it. So that involves lots. I mean, you said what made me laugh. Someone published a meme about me today, right, which I guess is fame of some kind.
It
said, what would Bill do? And it said, confuse them with Borman. And it's talking about somebody being in a client meeting, and he just went, yeah, I wonder what Borman would say about this. Let's confuse them. So I think generally, if you don't differentiate, so you have between paying work, other than that people are paying you for your time and some kind of outcome, and work, which is helping people, networking, giving your opinions, sharing stuff, talking at conferences, whatever it is, whatever audience it is, doing podcasts. If you treat all that with exactly the same passion and level of expertise, then things work out. And really, 80% of what you do generates 20% of billable time, if you want to call it like that.
Mm-hmm.
So people ask me very often, they asked me again at the meetup yesterday about work-life balance. I don't think there is work and there's life. I think there is only life, in which
so
work is a piece of it.
Yeah.
Work is a piece of it. So I think if we approach it like that and say, right, okay, what's my day job? You know, it really is seeing opportunities where I think I can add something or do something or bring some different thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And doing that, and sometimes that's directly in hiring projects with organisations, sometimes it's technology. With startups, it's a whole load of things, and it's a whole load of things from startup founders are typically quite young, so sometimes it's life stuff. You know, it's experience of being 50 something years old, talks a bit about life. Sometimes it's product. I do a lot of work on product with developers and try and translate what the market needs to what they do. Sometimes it's marketing, sometimes it's brand exposure. And for VCs, I work with VCs on understanding that their investments will be sound. So I think what you get is lots of work that fits together in the people that you're working with, whether that's companies who want to do hiring, whether it's, and then getting inside that, it helps you with the building, the design of products, and helping developers and quite often people who haven't worked in this people space but are building products with that. Helping investors to understand what would be wise choices in terms of investments and what would work, and just really recognizing that all those things are going to stick together. And I have a passion for startups because startups do disrupt the way we do things. They do disrupt our thinking, and sometimes because they have no experience and no background. So it's recognising that, but equally recognising that people change faster than companies. Companies are super tankers. They take 2 or 3 years, require lots of... You know, you work at Axel Springer, and pretty dynamic organisation, but at the same time, it's a corporation. If you want to change something, a practice, a process, it's going to take time. People change instantly. People are agile. Companies aren't. So it's helping companies to be... to recognise what people are really doing. I tend to say by the time... companies catch up with people, the people have moved.
Yep.
They're doing something different.
Mm.
So I really enjoy kind of trying to figure that piece out and help companies and candidates and everybody else in the marketplace get, and people at work get the technology that they need, and get companies, get startups thinking about that, what that is and how they build that. And it's not a replication of what exists. You know, there's no value in that. And then helping VCs to understand that. But where should we invest? What should we do? And also just scouting. I go to something like 40 countries a year and lots of places, lots of different events. We have about 100 true events. So I go lots of places and I see lots of startups and people are contacting me every day saying, can you have a look at my thing? And whenever I get the opportunity, I always will do. So it gives you a handle of products you can then bring back to VCs and say, I think you should have a look at this, or I think they could do with a steer, and kind of matchmaking in that respect. So all that work fits together in terms of the day job, but it could be lots of different things. The other thing is, I don't really have a time zone. So I work with people in Australia, Singapore, Japan, China. I work with people in the US, different time zones, and people in Europe. So and I guess I should say the UK now was a separate thing. So whenever you get up, which could be any time of the day according to when the work is, it's what's going to evolve. You'll have 3 or 4 activities, but lots of other things are going to evolve during that day, and it's just bid in. But who knows when you wake up in the morning.
Let's talk about TRU. You're the organizer and host of the TRU.
I'm the founder. I'm not the organizer as such. Okay. I organize TRU London. So what TRU is it's kind of more of it's really about mobilizing people rather than managing.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody wants to run an event anywhere, if you want to run an event in Berlin, you want to run an event anywhere, you could just do it. You don't need permission. You don't need a license. We ask you to kind of try and respect our values a bit, which is we don't have presentations other than product show and tells.
Mm-hmm.
We do product show and tells, which is where I connect investors with investors and influencers with products, with startups. But generally, we don't have any PowerPoint. It's round circles discussing recruiting issues. Anyone can take a session. There's no kind of speaker applications. So you buy a ticket, you turn up. Tickets are donation, so they're not bought for or paid for.
So it's completely different to the typical big HR conference.
The opposite of an HR conference. And then if anyone wants to run a true event, they can just do it. There's no business end. There's no money end. It's not a licensing end. You know, we just try and assist with that. So it really is trying to our way of connect, and it's recruiting space. So it doesn't matter whether you work for an agency, you work for a technology company, you're just interested in it. My daughter's 17. She came and talked about Gen Z and brought some of her friends who are new in the job market, like to throw in their opinions. So it's open to everyone.
Mm-hmm. How many people attend the conference?
Depends where the event is, but typically 100, 120. Okay. Paris, I think they have about 300. So it depends where the location is and who's organising it. I like round about 100 is a good number.
Yeah. And what kind of advantages do you see that it's not like a typical conference? Have no PowerPoint,
Yeah, one thing is everyone can contribute. The other one is a lot of the people who become speakers start with True.
Mm.
Everyone. So when I look around our space, kind of the headlines at a lot of the conferences began. And so I think we've provided a gateway of people getting known and getting onto the circuit. That's one thing. I think the other thing is because of the nature of the mix. So you've got technology companies, you've got, which you wouldn't have anywhere else. You know, normally events are for a type of person, they're for a practitioner or they're for a certain type of technology or whatever it is, but occupational apartheid, if you like, whereas I just mix everyone in and say no pitching. So I think you get a really interesting angle that you're talking about the same problem, whatever that might be, but people coming at it from different angles with their own expertise that I think you also go away with. You never really know what you're going to get. Sometimes it'll be a fantastic session. Sometimes it's okay because there's no scripted outcomes. But you'll go away with questions rather than necessarily answers to say, I need to find out more about this, and a much bigger network to help you solve your problems.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's different in that respect.
So it's about knowledge exchange, networking.
Yeah.
And do you also find answers?
You'll find answers in what you're doing. Yeah. More importantly, you'll find connections of people who've tackled problems who will happily talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really about networking and talking. And we're generally about 2 years ahead of where the market's going to land. So, you know, there's some really interesting stuff comes out of that.
Mm-hmm.
Really interesting. At the moment, you know, we're doing a lot on things like diversity and inclusion, also well-being. So we had like Pilates and meditation and, you know, just very different things for that audience.
Yeah. Let's talk about the HR market and the HR industry.
Yeah.
Pretty high level. What are the trends that you see?
So there's some significant trends I'm seeing going into 2019. So the first one is the way people are. When I talked about people being agile, so what I'm passionate about and I'm collecting data on at the moment is we know length of service is shrinking. The average is about 2.6 months. 2 years, 6 months with a company. So length of service is shrinking significantly. But at the same time, I believe people are more focused on their careers than ever before. They're focused on their careers in a different way. They're not focused on careers with a company. They're focused on careers for self.
Mm-hmm.
And they're looking at jobs for how is this job going to benefit me? And things like happiness at work is becoming more important. I'm at this place of work for a short period of time. Retention isn't important, but having a relationship with the organisation forever is. I think things like employer brand is shifting a lot. What I'm seeing in the I'm doing some data tracking for a company called Olio. I'm just writing a white paper for at the moment, and Symphony Talent, and which is the ATS ends of that market. And what I'm seeing from tracking digital brands is that people are really attracted to jobs, not to companies, in the way that we think they are. So they're not attracted to an employer brand in the way that we've been speaking as experts, that we craft things. What they're doing is they're attracted to jobs. So I'm calling that job brand. It's very much job brand. It's why job boards aren't dead, right? Yeah. It's why my daughter's 17. She sums it up well. She says, yeah, I apply for jobs on a particular aggregator or job board. And I said, why do you do that? He said, well, because all the jobs are there, right? So I think people are interested in jobs and how is this job going to help me become more employable in the future. So they're attracted to jobs and they apply, and they apply. What we're seeing is they're applying for multiple jobs rather than one job with multiple employers. And then when they get a response to that, to say, yeah, we're interested, they go to the pipeline, that's when they go and look at that's when employment brand comes important. Why employer brand becomes important is you're choosing one brand over another. Where do I go and work?
There was a girl yesterday on stage at the meetup.
Yeah.
And she was telling that it's no longer anymore about the career ladder. So it's more about careers like a jungle gym. Would you agree to that?
Kind of. You know, I think jungle gym is kind of a trendy way of putting it. But that's the reality is, it's not a career ladder. And organisations are still geared like that. They're still geared in terms of where they do performance reviews. They're geared over, we're going to send you on a training course every 2 years. We're going to dictate what that training and learning is. So if you work for us and we think, oh, you've got potential to become a supervisor or a manager, we'll tell you, right, that's your next career step. And we're going to provide you some training on that, and you're going, yeah, actually, I don't want to learn that because that's not what I want to do. I want to move into marketing, or I want to move into recruiting, or I want to do something different. So you'll, and because you won't work for organizations for long periods of time, you'll go and learn for yourself and identify a career for yourself, and your career might be quite different. So internal mobility is becoming more important, of looking at how we deal with that and who deals with that. Actually, because generally internal mobility has been dealt with in an organisation it's been an HR management development thing, managers identifying, saying this is where I want you to go, and really dictating things from the company's viewpoint. This is where the company wants you to go, this step. And people going, yeah, I don't really want to do that. Like, I don't want to manage people, and actually I'm fairly bored at what I'm doing, and I want to go and be creative or go and do something different, or marketing or whatever. I recognise that I've got to learn some stuff before I can do that. So are you giving me the opportunity to learn for myself, in my own time, whatever it is, learn for myself, meet people. If I apply for a job in the company, is it going to be held against me when I come back? There's another promotion. You know, is it going to be a negative thing for me, which it is in a lot of organisations, if we look at it. So I think we're thinking more about how we re-change that. And for me, what blocks internal mobility is visibility of opportunity. People don't see jobs. You know, so it all tends to be done in secret, like let's go for a coffee or a beer or whatever it is. It needs to be much more open. And I think internal mobility should be a function of talent acquisition. We should source it inside first before we source outside. And we shouldn't need permission to talk to people. And then it's about visibility of jobs, which is matching people and giving them visibility of opportunity, whether they've said they're looking or not. So they get the chance to consider that, and also career mapping of, right, this is where people have gone, where do you want to go, and these are the things that they've done, and get you thinking about your career in an organisation, and then it might move in multiple directions. I think as soon as we get rid of managers, actually the better.
And with internal mobility, you mean, okay, look at first at your own employees.
Yeah, train you should them. Always look at your employees first. Mm-hmm. So look at who you're already committed with, and then look at ex-employees. So boomerangs come after that. Mm-hmm. So how I see it is a new type of HR. So and lots of people get very emotional about this, but I think first of all, in recruiting talent acquisition, we have to have an acceptance that recruiting and talent acquisition is HR function. It's in HR. So wherever you go, you'll hear people saying, yeah, well, maybe we should report to marketing because it's more like marketing, or maybe we should report to someone else. It's an HR function. So I think accepting that it's an HR function, accepting that if we look at talent acquisition, 70 to 80% of our time and our budget and our money and our effort is spent on attraction rather than hiring. It's how do we get people to actually apply? What are we doing, employee branding, all that kind of thing? And that's really misplaced. So we can automate most of that. And we can automate pretty much all of that attraction and communication, outreach, branding, all that kind of stuff. So if we automate that, then what content do people respond to? What content do people... what makes someone stay connected with you, whether they're looking for a job or not, so that you have a candidate for life rather than a candidate for rather than an applicant for job? So if you think about it, a candidate is anyone who wants to be connected with your brand anytime, stay in touch with you. An applicant wants to be measured against a job. They've said, here is a job I'm interested in. Look at my CV against this job, invite me in for interview, give me some tests, make me do what I've got to do, but I'm interested in this job. Candidates are going, I'm interested in this company. So how do we stay connected with candidates so we can invite them to be applicants when it's appropriate, find out enough about them? I think the secret lies not in the employer branding stuff we're doing right now, like here's a video of us all having a good time and aren't we great, and here's our football machine and all that kind of stuff, but it's actually learning and development. Which touches on the stuff you were saying. If people don't stay with companies and they've got to learn individually, how do they learn? And they learn digitally. Access, it has to be free because you don't really have a budget for self or much. Most of us are just trying to pay our rents and eat and that kind of basic stuff. So what have you got that you can share with the world? Learning and development, opening up the doors and saying, here's the L&D stuff. So if learning and development is employer brand, and that's also why people take a job, because I can come in and learn, that's the number one attraction. I can come in and learn, make myself better, which will make me more employable for another employer, more attractive in the marketplace. How and where can we provide that from? And then if we're taking internal mobility into talent acquisition, right, what's the gap? The gap is learning. The career path and career mapping, which comes from a talent acquisition point of view of saying, right, these are where the jobs are going to be. These are the kind of things. This is what you're missing. If you applied for this job today, you wouldn't get it because you're lacking in da-da-da. Here's the content that you need. So my view is, my vision is what we'll see and what I'm trying to help organisations build is some kind of new role. We could call it people, we'll call it whatever you want, which talent acquisition is replaced. It isn't about talent acquisition because there's natural laws of attraction if you get your branding piece right. There's natural laws of attraction of how people find you. So that we make content about learning and development, progression about learning and development, career pathing, all that kind of stuff, and that we do all that, which sees learning and development, talent acquisition as one single function within HR, which takes care of people in their whole life cycle, including alumni, people who've left, people who've worked there before. And learning, because people won't get learning elsewhere, will keep people connected. So what becomes important is not retention of employment, but retention of relationship. Do you still respond when I reach out and message you? Do you still respond to that? And digitally, that's going to mean one-to-one messages rather than mass messages, and it's going to be in a messenger format.
Mm-hmm. And people who are following you know that social recruiting is also a very important topic for you, right?
Yeah, kind of. Well, that's a label that's been given to me because it's easy to say if you use Facebook.
Yeah.
For branding, you do YouTube stuff and you do all that kind of thing. It used to be, we used to call it social recruiting. The reality for me is it's recruiting.
Mm-hmm.
It's how you recruit people.
Yeah.
And it's using all of the channels that are available and appropriate. If the best way for me to hire a developer is to put a sandwich board on and walk up and down the street outside, then that's the channel that's available to me. If it's to go and speak at a meetup, if it's to do a podcast, there's so many different aspects to that that it's using everything that's available. And I think my reputation for social recruiting became that just because in the beginning, at the start of those times, I was just more imaginative about how you could use that than other people. I wasn't trying to do what I'd always done, just digitally, which is generally, you work in digital transformation, so usually what people are doing is saying, how do we take what we already do and just do it on a smaller screen or in a different way? And it's not the same. And I've been a bit more challenging to that, which is maybe why people have said social recruiting, but it's people, it's recruiting, right? Mm. That's what it is.
And to sum it up, do you have like your personal top three recommendations for recruiters and headhunters who are maybe listening right now?
Yeah, the first thing you've got to adopt is test practice over best practice. If you're doing what somebody's done before, so you go to a conference and you see best practice, you go, oh, that's best practice, right? That's what Google do, so we should do the same. We go, yeah, but you're not Google. You're not Facebook. You're not, right? You got to do what works for you. And you see it especially, right? So Germany is a really good example for me. So I used to work with a company called Euro London Appointments. So I was a non-exec director. We had offices in Frankfurt and Munich and Cologne. So I kind of had a feel for Germany a little bit. And the thing that always stuck out to me, particularly in Munich in Bavaria, was how we used to generate the candidates and have a loyal following for what we did was through the Stammtisch. I think we call it Stammtisch, like we'd hire a table in a
Stammtisch?
Bar. Stammtisch, mm-hmm. Right? And we built a business through Stammtisch, right?
Yeah.
And I was talking to actually a global organization, German organization, Hays, but the country managers, very recently at a meeting and saying, really, all we're doing digitally is taking that Stammtisch and doing it offline, doing it online, that principle of get people together, talking about whatever they want to talk, and make it possible by, and that was a very physical thing. You got the place, you paid for a few beers, you put on a Bratwurst, a hot dog or something, right?
Mm.
And people turned up for that. But you gave them a reason to connect in person. What we're really trying to do is the same thing digitally. It's that same principle of how do you give people a reason to connect and allow people to connect with each other so that when they want to come and work for you or they want to contribute or they can recommend someone to you, they will do. So it's really just building that and saying test practice over best practice. How do we try things and do things different? How do we understand that most things are going to fail? We're never going to achieve perfection in digital content, so just keep doing it. Put stuff out there. I think embracing that. And the biggest thing is stop thinking about candidates and applicants and hiring managers and go back to thinking about people. It's people connecting with people on a human level. Make things human, you know, and think what is in the best interest of everyone. I think at the moment we've got too hung up, especially in HR, we've got too hung up around how do I get a seat at the table? And in order to get a seat at the table, you know, any conference, you hear everyone say, and you heard it yesterday, right? You've got to think about the business and the business objectives and the business and link it into the business. And if you want to get budget, you've got to link it into the business and do this for the business. And that's great. But if we're doing everything for the business, who's doing anything for the people?
Mm. But I think that's absolutely right, but I think there are difficulties to transform it into the daily business routine. So to get rid of these roles and...
Yeah, so. Well, I don't think you do, because, you know, I can present things in a business way, but my driving force and my motive is the people, right? Because I know if I can make the people happy at work and I can give them the right tools to do their job and I can give them the freedom to do that and the freedom to make some mistakes and drive things, particularly when we're talking about digital transformation and things like changing leadership models, right? The way that we do things. If I can do that, then ultimately, in some level, then ultimately, it's going to deliver business results. Because I believe that, right? And then there's other things like saying, well, let's talk about something like candidate experience. Every time we talk about candidate experience, we try and present it as a, how much is it costing the business and what's the value and that's that kind of thing. And yeah, if you're a disposable retail brand like a mobile phone company or something like that, where people can change their contacts, then there's a bit of value in that. But really, what we need to be saying to an organisation is, you deal with digital transformation. I'm talking to people all the time and saying, right, let's forget about the ROI, let's forget about money, let's forget all of that stuff. Who do you want to be? Who do you want to be? Do you want to treat people well or not? Do you want to treat people badly? Forget about thinking of them as they might be customers, they might be consumers. What are you about? Because that's also what you're about as a person, right? In your own life, you're making your own choices about how do I want to treat people and what is right and what is wrong, what is ethical, what is moral. You don't think about what's going to make me money. And so when you take that approach to things like candidate experience and say, okay, whatever it does, how should we treat people? What would be reasonable? What's fair? Mm. What should they expect from us? And what should we expect from them? And are we communicating that? And is that reasonable? And we shouldn't have to do that because they might be customers or there might be money about it. We should do that because as an organisation, ultimately, we want to do good.
Mm.
But of course we want to make money, but we want to be good.
At the end, that it's not only a topic for HR departments.
It's business as a whole. But if if you work in HR and we deal with humans and we're working in HR, we are what that business is, right? You know, everything down to the culture, to the way we deal with people, to what our attitudes are, to what we think is acceptable and not acceptable and so on. We are whatever we decide as the people, it's going to be. That's why you can have value statements. You can have as many posters as you want. You can win as many great employer awards as you want because you can fill in great questionnaires. The reality of what you are as a company is those people who work for that company and how they feel about it. Even in a digital company where everything's online, right? Because it can be as simple as the processes that developers build or whatever it is, whether it's people-centric or not. And that's what I think we've got to do is, in an HR function, is we've got to say, yes, hold the business, we're here for the people. We're here for the people, and if we can get it right for the people, the business will perform and do well. We'll have the best working practices. If people enjoy what they do, they will make the effort. Fear is not a good controller of people. And if we can start to do those things, especially in today's world, if we can drive ourselves by what's good, it's not about profit, right? Profit is good. We should be driven by profit. We should always be thinking about how do we make the business successful. No issue with that. When people are passionate about the business, they want to make it successful. They want to make the best products. They want to do the best things. They want to develop the best processes. They want to do the right things. But we've got to basically look at it and say, right, especially in HR, what's going on for the people? If we get the people right, everything else will...
For the end of our interview, I prepared 2 or 3 personal questions.
Yeah.
It's always at the end, every guest has to answer to
Don't
it.
Don't you worry about it.
Yeah. What is work for you? So the podcast is about topics, about future of work and so on. How do you define work for yourself?
That's kind of a difficult one because... I ask, like, it's what I said, like, you know, I remember when they were quite young and they were going to school and said, Dad, what's your job? And I'm like, well, and we joked about it. And I said, yeah, my job is being me in all kinds of situations. And what do you do? Well, I do stuff that I get paid for. Because it really is very different between working with a startup to on product to maybe we're doing a design sprint, maybe we're talking about... in a company talking about process and application and how should we work. Sometimes it's training people, sometimes it's cultural change, sometimes it's content, sometimes it's speaking, broadcasting, whatever it is. So work is, I don't have a job, right? And I can't really call it work. I can't call it work. It's not like, oh, I'm going to work today, you know.
Because it's so much fun.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
It's fun and it's enjoyable. It's challenging a lot of the time, so I don't really think of it as work. But then you know, I don't have a job. I don't have an employer. I don't have someone I have to answer to, other than myself, right? So, I'm very different to most of the population who have to put on a suit and go work every day. So I don't consider it work. And I think, you know, what is work? Work is what most people have to do, the essential bit, in order to eat on a Friday, in order to pay bills. I think actually, this is an important topic to bring up. When we talk about future of work in podcasts like this, when we talk about disruption, recruitment processes, we tend to concentrate on the top 20-30% of talent, right? So we're talking digital, we're talking all this kind of stuff, senior people, CFOs, and that's where we talk about how do we attract these people, what are they motivated by, what they're looking for from a job and all that kind of thing. We underestimate that probably 70% of the workforce is motivated by, can I feed my kids next Friday, do I have paying work this week for 40 hours that's going to enable me to do that, am I going to get paid on time, these kind of motivators. In that, most of the people changing jobs are doing so at that end of the market. That's where most of the HR and recruiting activity is going on. And we focus on our bubble is talking about the top 20-30%. So how's work changing? How is work changing for that end of the market? And really, it's getting worse. We're using technology to figure out how do we cheat these people more? How do we make people poorer, really? You know, and how do we make sure we only pay them for the hours that they work, and we make it hard for them to get jobs, hard for them to connect with work. Lots of organisations, you know, without wanting to highlight any in particular, but people like Deliveroo and so on, DHL in the UK, delivery companies, delivery, especially logistics, you know, how do we make it hard for people, removing people's holiday pay, all kinds of things, perfectly legally, right? So no one's doing anything illegal. Figuring out how do we maximise the profit in the deal so we can charge the lowest price and give the biggest convenience. And so I think when we talk about work, we've got to recognise, so, you know, I'm a gig worker, really. I do gigs. But there's two different types of gig. I credit David D'Souza for this quote. It's not an original, but something that really resonated with me when I saw a slide that he put up. David D'Souza from the CIPD. And what David talks about is, when we talk about gig workers, we normally talk about the people who chose to be gig workers, like me. The people who are getting very well rewarded for a limited number of hours and a lot of expertise in certain circumstances, right? So we choose to be gig workers. We choose not to be employed, and we have the benefit we can earn enough money in a certain amount of time to make that okay. Most people who are gig workers don't choose to do that. They have no other available lifestyle or no other available means of earning. So I'm very passionate and driven. Okay, sorry, this was supposed to be a personal question, but I'm very passionate and driven about the fact that actually that's not quite right. We need to figure out how we change that.
What are you learning currently, what you cannot do yet?
Everything all the time. Right? You know, and
Something special?
Yeah. I mean, my big thing over the last couple of years, really, I've had four real interests, which I think reflects lots of different parts of my life. So my children are 17, 19, puts you on a different mission about what you want. And my children really opened my eyes to all kinds of things around diversity, LGBTIQ. I've met people, for example, Joe Lockwood, who've really educated me in terms of all kinds of things like the trans community and difficulty for people who are autistic. I was at an event recently, RL100, who's run Wreckfest, great events, who were talking about autism. Unleash, I speak at Unleash, the kind of the three conferences that I measured the year out is between London. Mm-hmm. You know, anyone who can should do London, Paris and San Francisco as a measure of the year. So what's going on? And they've had happiness speakers talking about happiness. And I'm beginning to understand. I used to think happiness was kind of hippie, hug a tree stuff. I'm beginning to understand that. I'm beginning to understand. I'm spending more time with street artists and people who are creative. I'm doing stand-up comedy, which is really something I took on and doing over the last 12 months, which has helped me learn a lot of stuff. Looking at the creative process, and I think we've spent so long on STEM, especially in Germany, right? We've spent so long on STEM, science, technology, this is going to be the future. And our schools have been driven like sausage factories to say we must get good marks in maths, we must get good marks in technology, we must make women engineers, we must do this, we must do that. That everything that's been driven out of education and life in many ways due to time restraints is art and creativity. But the reality is, when we look at machine learning recommendation, what we're going to need more of is art and creativity. We're going to need more people who have creative thinking, who are artistic. So I'm learning a lot about life from kind of street artists and some really good street artists. Hello the Mushroom, London Subdued, political art and stuff, right? There's lots of material. So I'm really, and they also are at True Events doing street art. So I'm learning a lot from kind of artists, unusual people. And the other thing is cooking. I've learned that I love to cook. So I've been in Italy a couple of times learning to make pasta and cooking.
Right.
And I think you have to, especially if you work for yourself, is you have to learn that it's okay to spend an hour, 2 hours cooking. It's good to realize, it's good to, you know, it's positive for you to find these hours.
Like meditation sometimes.
Yeah. So my learning has been really looking at diversity and thinking about that and class system and what that means. And, you know, we're going through particularly political turmoil in the UK with Brexit and this kind of thing, you know, which is, for someone like me who considers themselves to be European and work in Europe and living in a place that doesn't consider itself European, I'm witnessing a lot of conflict in that, right? And lots of things. So I'm having to learn, how do I deal with that? So the learning that I should speak up about things. I shouldn't be thinking about how will that affect my business plan. If I don't like something that's going on in the US or wherever it is, I should speak out about that. And I should try and embolden and empower people to speak about things in the right way. So the things I'm learning is really, how do you deal with that? Because, you know, I've never been in a position in my life, if I think back, where significant political conflict and division, enough, I've always been passionate about things, but I've never felt passionate about things to the point where I'm going on street marches and getting angry about stuff, right? And I'm arguing with people on Facebook and putting quite a lot of time into these kind of things, where politics and those kind of things and a sense of justice around different communities, and actually looking at it and saying, you know what, I never knew, I don't want to say white privilege or any of that stuff, but I never knew the advantages and benefits that I've had in my life that other people don't.
Mm.
And I'm beginning to see that because of my children and some of the people they're introducing to me and people I meet. And I'm beginning to say, yeah, your life is pretty hard and there are some things here that are wrong. And we need to stand up and be counted about that. At the same time, it's discovering this artistry and creativity and saying we need to do something, whether that's do a bit of comedy or do whatever you do, right? We need to do things that are different.
Bill, we're at the end of our interview.
Yeah, it's been great. Time's flown by.
Thank you for your time and thank you for the insightful interview.
My pleasure.
Have a safe trip home.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.